Hi, everybody. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
Somebody from the group had asked, so today is my first session. I'm doing six sessions. So my last one is August 11th. And the first time you guys need another speaker is August 18th. So just whatever. It's good to be here. I have a lot of respect for this group. I can't say that about a lot of meetings. It's always cool being here. I don't remember the last time I was here. It was a couple of years ago, probably. I'm going to do 6 weeks each week. It's somewhat step-related, but it's basically 6 weeks of sort of topics that I've wanted to kind of go off on for a while. So some of it's going to be somewhat... Most of it's going to be big book related, and some of it may not be, so deal with it. I guess I came to AA June 3rd, 1991, and I floundered around AA for 3.5 years. And during that period of time, my life really sucked. I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't using non-conference approved substances, but I can't say that my life was getting better. I made the mistake at first of believing that drinking was my problem, so not drinking was my solution, which I'm sure there's some people here that believe that. And if you don't hear anything else these next 6 weeks, I hope to disprove that theory. 'Cause first of all, alcohol is not my problem. Second of all, if alcohol is my problem, then I just have to not drink and then my problem goes away. But in my case, and in the case of alcoholics, that's not how it works. For the 3.5 years when I first came here, I wasn't drinking. 100% of the time, I wasn't drinking. But slowly but surely, my life became more and more miserable. And slowly but surely, you know, if this is what it's going to be like, this sucks, so I might as well just drink, or I might as well just kill myself or whatever. But for those 3.5 years, my life was getting progressively more and more miserable because my problem wasn't alcohol, even though I thought it was. And I was going to a lot of meetings around Friendship Hall in Piscataway, especially at Friendship Hall in Piscataway. And what I heard there a lot was, don't drink and go to meetings. And don't drink and go to meetings is good advice for about 2 weeks. But it's not a recovery program. So it's interesting. The 6 week workshop, tonight's topic that I wanted to talk about was what really is the problem called alcoholism, and what is a solution to it. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. So I'm going to Friendship Hall mostly, and I got connected pretty quickly with a bunch of people there, a bunch of guys. I used to refer to them as the Muppets because they were sort of these characters, you know what I mean? Like, they were these characters. That's the thing I love about AA, is that we're a fellowship of characters. It's really, really cool. And it's kind of amazing. And you know, there's things that go on here that I experienced fellowship. I experienced connectedness with a group. I experienced the sharing of collective wisdom, which is very cool about AA. Something that maybe you haven't noticed is that every culture before America had a storytelling element to it, which is how they carry the wisdom stories. And for some reason, America decided to disregard the wisdom stories. And the cool thing is that AA brought back the wisdom stories. So, be very grateful and realize how fortunate you are that here the wisdom stories are still carried. I never found answers on how to live until I came here. I didn't learn how to live from my family because I didn't relate to them. they were a group of goody-goodies, and I couldn't relate. I didn't learn from school how to live my life. I didn't learn from the news how to live my life. I didn't learn from my friends how to live my life. I didn't learn from the major sports programs that I got involved in how to live my life. I didn't learn how to live my life from my brothers. And that was why I was such a failure at life. And then I discovered alcohol. And when the first time that I drank, the experience of alcohol, which is sort of how I'm going to close with a reading tonight on how I see AA, but alcohol was an interesting concept, but the experience of alcohol was a spiritual experience for me. Because for the first time in my life, I was 13 years old when I had my first drink, and I was 16 when I got drunk for the first time. That time when I was 13, I had a couple drinks, at first unknowingly, and then what had happened was, I always like telling this story because it shows you how old I am. I come from a really, really wonderful family. I feel really blessed. But because they were such a wonderful family, I didn't relate to them. So I was blessed and I was cursed with the same family. And when I was 13, every Sunday we would go to church in Yonkers, New York. We lived in Tarrytown, New York until I was 10. And then we lived in White Plains, New York until I was 18 or 19 or like 19. And then I kind of ran away screaming and took a hostage and moved to New Jersey. And the rest is really pathetically downhill after that. One Sunday when I was 13, we went to church in Yonkers. And then we came back to Hastings on Hudson, which is where my grandmother lived. And we would have lunch. And we would watch one of the greatest shows of all time, The Bowery Boys and Abbott and Costello. And for those of you that are my age, that was a golden time of television as far as I'm concerned, with unbelievably incredible television shows that you know, far surpassed anything that's on TV today. I mean, think about it. You know, we have like 600 channels, and you know, weekly we can go through all the channels and not find anything. Like, how is that even possible? You know, but I was sitting in the living room of my grandmother's house. We had just had lunch, and my second oldest brother was going around asking people, you know, what do you want to drink? And the adults were getting whatever they were drinking, alcoholically associated. And I told him I wanted a ginger ale, and he brought me a rye and ginger ale, which is, I understand, is called a highball. And I drank it pretty quickly, and I immediately realized two things. One, this is not ginger ale. And two, I'm doing something I know I shouldn't do, and I'm really enjoying it. Those are two things that happened to me that day. Was two things that really, really took me down. Was, you know, I really got off on doing things I knew I shouldn't be doing. Which fortunately still isn't the case today. That day, for the first time in my life, now I come from a pretty big family, but for the first time in my life, except for when I played sports. When I played sports, it was a spiritual experience for me. I was a very great athlete. I played semi-pro baseball. I was captain of my hockey team. I was captain of my baseball team. I was an incredible athlete. Because I had three older brothers, so I was always playing with people that were older and better than me. So that made me really, really good. I was an all-star athlete. And besides sports, I was very introverted. I was very uncomfortable. I was very on the outside. I was very isolating. I was very, very, very uncomfortable within my own skin. And that day at my grandmother's house, when I drank a couple drinks of alcohol, for the first time in my life, outside of an athletic experience, I felt comfortable where I was, doing what I was doing with the people that I was with. And those three things had never come together in my life ever before. And I made a mental note that I will be doing this again. And if I was completely emotionally and mentally honest with the experience of that first day that I drank, I would have jumped up and ground and was like, yes, yes, I found it. It did something for me that I had never experienced before, and I chased that. I chased that until I was 30, and 30 is when I went to my last rehab, my last I'm not first rehab. When I was 13, that was a great day. And then, I kind of eased into it because I knew I was doing something I shouldn't do. And then, by 16, it was, a few times a month. By 17, it was weekly. And from 18 to 30, it was basically a daily thing. I loved alcohol. But I really didn't see what was really going on there because, one of the aspects of alcoholism is progression. So you start a certain way, or let's put it this way, however you were drinking that year, over a period of time, it was just getting worse. Hey, darling, can you put your phone away? Thanks. So progression is kind of an interesting thing that, pretty quickly, it was the magic elixir. So, I went from going to the basement of my parents' church, and I would put cash in the can and take a case of Black Label. I used to steal Black Label from my parents' church. And at first I would put money in, and then after that I wouldn't put money in, I would just steal it. And what I was doing was I was trying to make friends. I was showing up at high school gatherings on golf courses and in the woods in Westchester County, and I was the one that brought the beer, so I was cool because of that, and I was buying friends, basically, was what was happening. And on my 18th birthday, that was when I had my first blackout. I know that's sort of a contradiction of terms. I remember my first blackout. It seems unusual, I know, but I totally remember it like it was yesterday. It's funny, over the years, I have really thought about what happened that day. And my conclusions have changed over the years, and more recently, in thinking about it, I'm pretty sure that one of my friends put something in my drink. And that was why I went into a blackout. Because that day, when the blackout started, we hadn't really started partying yet. I had some beers, and I smoked a joint or two or something like that, and we were sitting in front of somebody's house. And then before we went into the house, I already was in a blackout. But I hadn't, now in looking back, I didn't realize it until recently that I really hadn't partied much. Why would I have gone into a blackout? And especially my first one. So I think one of my friends did something. But I know later that night, it was probably like 2 or 3 in the morning, and that was when I came out of the blackout. I was in a car with someone I had never seen before. What I discovered later was the older brother, the guy whose house was the one that had the party. And, where did my friends go? Because I went there with two friends. So why wasn't I being driven home by my two friends? So I know something really bad happened at the party. I also know that I had three vinyl records with me that were given to me by my brother for my birthday. And one of the vinyl records had a piece chipped off of it. So, and also on Monday when I went to school, I got some kind of strange looks by the guy who had the party and by people that were at the party. So that was when I first learned, you just don't ask a lot of questions. You know what I mean? Like, I was in a blackout. I'm pretty sure something bad happened, but, let's act as if nothing happened. And still to this day, I don't know what happened. But I'm highly intrigued by it. And it's funny because some years ago, they passed around a questionnaire for people that graduated from my high school. And what they were doing is, I guess there's these, the world is filled with people that just want more and more information. And these are there's these groups of people that help organize reunions. And so they went to our high school and said, give us all the information of all the people. We'll get their current information, and then that'll help with whenever you want to do a reunion for that one class. And I got all the information back. And the guy whose party was lives in Pennsylvania, and I have his phone number now. So sometime later this year, I'm going to contact him and start the conversation by saying, you know, this is probably the weirdest conversation you're going to have this year. But, you know, this is Bill Lash, and you probably remember me. And, you know, do you remember that 18th birthday on March 3rd that I think I did something really bad at your party? And could you please explain to me what happened? Because I don't remember any of it, you know. So I remember my first blackout. And then from, you know, from 18 to 30, I drank alcoholically. You know, one of the ways that I describe what it was like is that when I was 17, I went to this party, and when I was 30, I came home from that party. And that pretty closely describes my life and the progress that goes along with that. You know what I mean? Now, during that period of time, there were certain people, sometimes girlfriends, sometimes friends, sometimes employers, sometimes family members, that seemed to want to suggest that I had a drinking problem. Now, drinking was my magic elixir, so I don't know what you're talking about. If alcohol did for you what it does for me, you would never suggest that I stop drinking. It was the only tool for living that I had, besides anger and lying. Anybody here famous liars? Right? That was one of my earliest tools for living, was lying, and realizing that, wow, I could just say whatever I want, and most people will, and you can just get away with it. You can say anything, you know. It's funny because there was a movie that came out some years ago called The Invention of Lying, and I felt I had invented lying. It was cool in the beginning because you could literally say anything, and then, you know, you become sort of a pathological liar. So lying was my first drug of choice, really. That was the first way that I learned how to twist reality, but then through substances and alcohol and stuff, then I learned how to twist reality also. No tools for living, though. So you have to understand, you know, the immense uncomfortability within myself. And then the progression of alcoholism. At first, alcohol was really working for me, no problems. Two, alcohol is working for me, but then there's occasional problems. And then alcohol is working for me, and there's lots of problems. And then alcohol is not working for me, and there's constant problems. And that was the progression of my alcoholism, really. It's no way to live. It's no tool for living, but, you know, when that's all you got, that's what you go with. And then, you know, at age 30, I went into my second rehab, and I haven't had a drink since. So I was talking about the first 3 years when I came to AA. So last rehab, Clearbrook in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and then 3.5 years, but miserable in AA. That was when I first realized that there's more going on here than not drinking. I had looked at the steps. I always refer to the steps as intellectually insulting. Because intellectually, I mean, this is what you got. You know what I mean? Like, this is what you got. That's I can come up with a better program than that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, where's the loan step? You know, I need a loan. You know, where's the loan step? You know, where's the spokesmodel girlfriend step? You know what I mean? Where's the sweet car step? You know what I mean? Like, this is intellectually insulting, but the cool thing about the steps is that it doesn't care what you think about it, it just wants you to experience it. And when you experience it, it's a game changer. Experiencing the steps is the greatest tool for living that I've ever come across. Thank God. Thank God that I have something, you know what I mean? There's a lot of people that don't have a 12-step fellowship or anything. And people like that, that have sort of the same inner experience that we have, you see, there's these sociopaths and other psychological terms of people that that have similar interior experiences that we have, but as alcoholics, we have alcohol to help us deal with that. But then when we stop drinking, because then we shift into, well, drinking is causing problems. Then when we shift into, okay, well, I need to stop drinking, then the internal experience is still there. The problem is still there. Our problem is not alcohol. Our solution is alcohol. Our problem is that we don't know how to deal with life, we don't know how to deal with other people, and we don't know how to deal with our emotions. So I come to AA and I think alcohol is my problem, and then for 3.5 years I'm just progressively miserable as time passes. I thought alcohol was my problem. And I was hearing a lot of don't drink and go to meetings, and I was hearing a lot of... Now, I didn't hear this, but this is what I saw. And what I saw was, if you hang with us, we'll keep you sober. And one of the best examples I can give of that is, I remember me and this other guy, the member of the Muppets, me and this other guy were hanging out with the Muppets, and that was our part of our, whatever you want to call it, part of our network. And what the suggested or what the stated practice was, whenever any of us go on a speaking commitment, we all meet at Friendship Hall and we all go together to the speaking commitment. And you know, that's nice. You know, that's nice. But one of the guys that was part of me and the Muppets, he started having problems with his wife because when he was drinking, he wasn't around much, and now he's going to AA and he's not around much. So she sort of preferred that he drink, to be honest with you, because then sometimes he was home more, you know what I mean? Because you can't drive or you can't go out or whatever. And so he started having problems with his wife, and we were going on a speaking commitment that was across the street from his house. And what everybody was saying was, yeah, but now you need to drive, you know, 20 minutes or a half hour to Friendship Hall to meet all of us, to then drive across the street from your house. And he said, he let everybody know, you know, listen, I'll just meet you guys at the meeting because, you know, I can spend more time with my wife. And it was very obvious to me and him that he was doing the right thing. And everybody else was giving them crap about it because, no, we all go to Friendship Hall and we meet there and then we go to the speaking commitments. And, you know, I looked at him and he looked at me and we were just like, you know, this is stupid. Like, this is odd. And that was when both of us started realizing, you know, there's sort of this assumed, you know, hang with us and we'll keep you sober kind of thing. And where does it say that? You know what I mean? Like, now it was never said, but it was just this, it was what was practiced, sort of. And that was when he started getting a little disillusioned with what was being laid down. And I was starting to get a little disillusioned with what was being laid down because I was not happy. And I was thinking that I want to drink because this really sucks. And that was when I ran into the first recovered, transformed person that I had ever met. And... that was Sam H. He lived in Middlesex, and he used to go to Friendship Hall sometimes, and I would see him there. And Sam, when I had 2.5 years, Sam had 7 years, and he was the most miserable person in the room. And Sam, I always describe as a combination of Santa Claus and a Hell's Angel. He was this big, huge guy with a big, huge, furry beard and a big, huge thing of hair and tattoos everywhere. He was a really big guy. And when I had 2.5 years and he had 7 years, he was so incredibly angry and squirrely and capable of saying and doing anything that, you know, if he had walked into the room and sat down next to you, you would just move. Like, this guy, you don't cross paths with this guy. You don't go next to him in the parking lot. I saw him jump across tables and grab people. I saw him drag people out. This guy was one of the scariest people I had ever seen. You know, that's what it looks on the outside to us. But what's really going on there was that he was probably the most fearful person in the room. In reality, that was really what was going on. But what we were seeing was, you know, violence and unpredictability and being, you know, crazy. But in reality, what I said was, what's going on with people like that? It's that they're the most afraid person in the room. So, of course, they're going to act like that. So I had 2.5 years. He had 7 years. And then something happened to him, and his whole entire life changed for the better. And all of a sudden, he went to the most unapproachable person in the room to the most approachable person in the room. He went from the most uncomfortable in his own skin person in the room to the most comfortable person in his room. And he became a wonderful spiritual man, and he still is. And I couldn't reconcile that, because for 2.5 years, he was my poster child for maybe I'm not so bad. When I was drinking, I always surrounded myself with people like that. You know what I mean? Like, I would drink with people with worse drinking problem than I did, because then I didn't look so bad. You know what I mean? And Sam was my poster child for maybe I don't have it so bad. And then Sam got better, and I couldn't relate to it, and it really pissed me off, because, you know, he's doing, like, it was, what I started thinking was, you know, here's another example of God hates me, and the worst person in the room just got better, and I'm lost, and scared, and pissed off, and uncomfortable. But, you know, now I have 3 years, 3.5 years, you know, part of what goes on is that you have to put on a mask. You have to make it seem like you're doing well. People are asking you to sponsor them. You have 3.5 years. It's a real nightmare, because you can't get real, because if you do, no one would ever believe how bad it is. But you just reach a point where I might as well just drink. If this is what it's going to be like, I might as well just drink, or I might as well just kill myself, because this totally sucks. It's not happening here. I'm not finding any answers. It's not. I'm seeing how well he's doing, and I'm just getting worse. And I hated it, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It's a really, really ugly place. Because you see, when we're drinking, at least we have moments of relief, and we have moments of escape, and we have moments of blackout. But when you're living with that, and you're not drinking anymore, you have no moments of escape. You have no release from it at all. You are insane, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it, and it's just getting worse. And you're exacerbating it, because, you know, if somebody asks you how you're doing, you're fine. You know what I mean? Like, you're F-I-N-E fine, you know. But then Sam gets better. You know what I mean? The poster child for I don't have it so bad gets better. So I had heard people tell their stories about how they were used to do bad and now they're doing better. I had heard people tell the story of the transformation. But at 3.5 years is the first time that I see the transformation. Like, I see that, wait a minute, Sam was, you can't get there from here. Like, wait a minute, what's going on here? First transformed person I had ever met in seeing the experience. And for about a year, I was afraid to say anything to him, because I came to the conclusion that he must have found some good meds. And that would not have been an answer for me. And then I went to the Area 44 convention, which was announced tonight, so that's cool. And I ran into Sam and his wife, who was good friends with my girlfriend at the time, who I'll affectionately refer to as my future second ex-wife. And Lisa was good friends with Sammy and Michelle, and Sammy and Michelle comes walking in, and we're at the Area 44 convention, and Lisa needed to talk to Michelle, so they kind of go off on the side, and I'm left talking to Sam, and I decided to get real, and I decided to get honest, perhaps for the first time ever. And I said, Sam, you know, a year ago I noticed that you went from a really, really negative element in meetings and in the world, and now you seem all right with yourself. I more relate to the first guy. My life sucks. And, you know, I didn't do like a fifth step with him, but, you know, for like 10, 15 minutes, I sort of started rattling off. I was trying to impress him. You know what I mean? I was trying to impress him on how bad my life was. And through that 15-minute conversation, he at one point he sort of snickered a little bit about something that I was sharing about, you know, what was happening in my life currently. And then toward the end of that part of our conversation, I shared something and he laughed out loud because what I was sharing was so pathetic. And finally I stopped and I said, Sam, you know, I don't appreciate you laughing at me. This is really, really difficult for me. And I don't see what's so funny. And that was when him seeing me straighten up and get real. That was when he straightened up. And he said something to me, and I didn't realize it at the time, but he actually big booked me. And what he said was, he said, Bill, I know it doesn't look like it, and I know it doesn't feel like it, but you're in a really great place. And I said, Sam, I don't think you're listening to me, because there's no part of our conversation that could ever be described as you're in a really great place. This is a nightmare for me, and I don't appreciate you laughing at me. And he said, no, I'm telling you, you're in a really great place. And this is what he said, and it was so beautiful. He said, no, you're in a really great place because, you see, you only have two options. You can either go on living the way you're living, and I'm telling you right now, it's only going to get worse. Or you can consider another way besides your own. And I looked at him, and I said, Sam, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. There is no other place besides, there is no other way besides my own. I have no idea what you're talking about. And then that was when I popped him the question of, you know, Sam, I knew you were doing really, really bad, like worse than I'm doing now. But I know that you're not there anymore. So what happened to you? And then that was when he proceeded to explain that the late, great Howard G., who became my sponsor, had confronted him after a meeting. And Sammy's this huge guy. Howard's this scrawny Jewish man. Probably the most unintimidating person you could ever find. And Howard literally walked up to Sam at the end of a meeting. Sam went in the back room to get coffee because he wasn't a hold hands kind of person. And he went to the back of the room to avoid everybody and to get the hell out of there because the meeting had ended. And Howard walked up to him and said, Sam, excuse me, but are you as miserable as your face suggests? And I really don't know why Sam didn't just backhand him across the room, because he had done that. I had seen him do it. And Howard had gotten so in his face that Sam broke down and started crying and said, I'm more miserable than my face looks. And Howard brought him to his house and started taking him through the big book, and absolutely every single area of his life changed for the better. And that was a year earlier. And I saw that transition. I saw that he went from a really, really bad person to a really, really good person. How do you do that? Like, so, you know, now I'm talking to the dude. You know what I mean? I'm talking to the dude. And I'm so happy that his answer wasn't, I found good medication, you know. I'm not necessarily putting medication down, but yeah, I am putting medication down. All right, so. Sam proceeded to tell me something that I had never heard before, and I had been in AA for 3.5 years, and it really pissed me off because I was like, why is this news to me? And he said, Bill, you know, Howard explained to me what alcoholism is, that the big book talks about a physical, mental, and spiritual disease, and that we have here in AA a physical, mental, and spiritual solution. And he talked about that when we drink alcohol physically, what happens is we set off a craving where we want more alcohol and we can't safely predict how far it's going to go. And that physically it does something for us that it doesn't do for non-alcoholics. That when I drink alcohol, I get this in control, get up and go into town, yeah, I want more kind of a feeling. And that non-alcoholics get this out of control, beginning of a nauseating, I don't like this, so I don't want any more kind of feeling. And that's why, you know, there were times where I drank with people that didn't drink like I did. And we would have 2 or 3 drinks, and I'd be going to get another one, and I'd say to them, you know, can I buy you a drink? And they'd say the most preposterous thing I've ever heard, and that is, no, because I'm feeling the first one. I mean, that's the whole reason why I'm going to get more. What are you talking about? Like, I'm feeling the first one. What are you talking about? And then they would do something even more bizarre. They would leave and make it home for dinner. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like a Wednesday, and they're, you know, they you know, the dinner's on the stove. You know, like, what are you talking about? Like, the bar's open and I have money. That makes no sense to me. Going home on, you know, for dinner on time. Like, what is that? I could never do that. And because alcohol does something for us that it doesn't do for a non-alcoholic, when I stop, I get a mental obsession that I don't see the truth about alcohol. That what my mind tells me is that this time it's going to be different. What my mind tells me is I can have just one. And it's funny because there's still a story that rattles in my head every once in a while, and that's that I just hadn't found the right combination of stuff to start my day with that will allow me to not lead to it going too far. Like, there's this story in my head that I laugh at constantly because it's like, yeah, I'm going to try that one. Yeah, that just sounds like a great idea. It was, you know, the right combination of pasta and, you know, bread or something. You know what I mean? Like, I have to start, you know, I have to have a full stomach first or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's this theory that my mind throws up every once in a while that's just laughable to me. But when I'm in the cups, that's how it is. You know what I mean? My mind tells me this time it's going to be different. This time it's not going to be bad. I'm not going to get arrested. I'm not going to lose my girlfriend. I'm not going to lose my job. And then, you know, I walk into the bar and I'm spitting bullets and I'm pissed at everybody and don't even look at me. And then I have a few drinks and I love you, man. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden, everybody's my best friend. And what just happened there? And then I overshoot the mark and I start drinking so I can talk to some women. And then I'm too drunk to talk to women. And what the hell just happened there? You know what I mean? And then I go into the bathroom and I throw up or something. And if anybody here is... if anybody here has ever experienced this, I can guarantee that you're an alcoholic. And that is that we start drinking, we drink too much, we throw up, and then we continue drinking. Now, if you did that, you are an alcoholic. But there's no person in this world that ever ate lobster and got sick and then continued eating lobster. You know what I mean? The first time that I drank to the point where I threw up, we were drinking Tanqueray. And we went to JFK Airport, and we dropped off a friend of mine, and we were just drinking out of a bottle. And we went to the airport, dropped my friend off. We went around the parking lot, and we stole a bumper from a Mustang, because my friend had a Mustang who damaged the bumper, and we needed a bumper, so we drove around the airport, unscrewed a bumper off of one of the Mustangs in the parking lot, put it in the back of the Mustang, and drove off. And as we're leaving the parking lot, I got sick because I had drank too much Tanqueray. I still to this day, and that was very early on, still to this day I've never drank Tanqueray ever again. The second alcohol that I got sick from was what was that stuff that Janis Joplin really liked? No. Not what she died from. Oh, Southern Comfort. She loved Southern Comfort. The second alcohol that I got sick from was Southern Comfort. Never drank Southern Comfort again. But and then Sam continued to talk about you know, so that's the mental obsession, that my mind doesn't see the truth about alcohol. It lies to me about how it's going to go. And you know, I never overshot the mark, so why is my mind telling me that I'm going to this time? But that's part of the mental obsession that we have, that when we start, it goes too far, and when we stop, we can't stay stopped. And then he talked about the spirituality, and the spirituality part of that conversation was the most significant to me, because... you know, I had 3.5 years, and I was completely miserable because all I was doing was going to meetings and not even being real and not pursuing any kind of spiritual solution or steps or anything like that. And he talked about the spiritual malady. The 12 and 12 has one of the best ways of describing it. It's self-centered fear. You know, it's the inner experience of I can't deal with life, I can't deal with my emotions, and I can't deal with other people. I wake up in the morning and I have a script in my head about how you're supposed to act and how traffic's supposed to be and how work's supposed to go, and then I leave my house and I'm surrounded by script violators. And I can't understand why I just can't be right. And I know that alcohol helps me with that. You see, I have to replace the ease and comfort that comes at once by drinking alcohol with the ease and comfort that comes gradually over working the steps and living a spiritual life. Let me repeat that. I have to replace the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. If any of us, assuming that you're an alcoholic, which I'm never going to do, but let's assume that you're an alcoholic, you haven't drank in a while, your gut's crazy, your head's crazy, your mind is chewing you up and spitting you out. If you go and drink right now, it'll help you with that. Because you see, the crazy thoughts in our minds and the spiritual blockages and the emotional craziness that's within us, that's a really big part of our life. When we drink, it takes a whole committee of voices just screaming at me, and it funnels it down to one voice that says, just drink more. And it quiets the mind. It quiets the gut. It quiets the craziness. But you see, when I drink, then I unleash the beast. One of the best ways I've ever heard of how that works is that, you know, if you have sex with a gorilla, it's not over until the gorilla is finished. Does anybody here not relate to that analogy? When it comes to alcohol, you know, alcohol has its way with you. You understand what I'm saying? In every sense of the term. That's a really great mental picture, though, isn't it? Good luck going home and sharing that with somebody. But it has its way with you. You know, it would have its way with me. You know what I mean? Like, I was never... Once I started, I was never sure. You know, when somebody said, you know, let's go have one, you know, for them, they were going to have one. For me, it was like, you know, let's go have 1 week. You know what I mean? Like, it was just... It was just this whirlwind of who knows where this is going to go. You know, I wonder if I remember a bunch of years ago, we went to an AA meeting, and after the meeting, we went to a Chinese restaurant, and we ordered some food, and the food started coming out, and a guy came with some glasses and put down a bottle of wine. And it was in the middle of the summer, and it was for the table next to us. And when he put down the bottle of wine, he looked at us, and we all had this sort of strange look on our face. And he goes, is this not for you? And I turned to him, and I said, no, we have plans for Christmas. And it was like June, you know what I mean? And he couldn't understand what I was talking about. Everybody at the table just busted out because they completely understood what I was saying. You know, I have plans for Christmas, you know what I mean? Like, if I start now, those plans are out the door, absolutely. And that's what it's like, you know. And it's funny because Sam outlined the you know, I guess let's call it the circle and triangle, physical, mental, and spiritual problem. And then in a few minutes I'll do the circle and triangle, physical, mental, and spiritual solution. And after he was finished with that part of it, he kind of said, you know, do you relate to that? That when you start, you can't predict how far it's going to go. And when you stop... you can't stay stopped, and that it's crazy inside of you. And I said, one, not only do I completely identify with that, two, why is this news to me? I've been in AA for 3.5 years. Why did you people keep this from me? And three, no wonder why I'm so crazy, and no wonder why I'm so miserable. Because I haven't even touched the problem yet. I've been in AA for 3.5 years. I thought, don't drink and go to meetings is the solution. I thought that alcohol is the problem, so not drinking is the solution. And for the first time after 3.5 years, when I was getting ready to kill myself, I was laid out what the problem really is, and I totally 100% identified with it. No wonder why I'm so miserable. I thought the steps just applied to really bad alcoholics. They didn't apply to me. That's a pathetic program. It's a pathetic program. It doesn't touch me where my problems are. And I said to him, why is this news to me? I've been coming here for 3.5 years. Why is this news to me? I'm so grateful for him carrying the message the way he did. It was a miracle. It was a miracle. You know, what had happened was after 3.5 years, I became desperate and I couldn't blame alcohol for it. I had 3.5 years sober. I couldn't blame alcohol for it. I could blame alcoholism, which is what I was learning that day, but I couldn't blame alcohol for it. The only thing I could blame was my best thinking and the way I was living my life. That's the only way that I could explain why am I so miserable. And now I'm faced with what the problem really is. It's not alcohol. It's why I drank in the first place. and wow, did that hit me. Why is this news to me? Why did you people keep this from me? And it's strange because, you know, within weeks after going back to Friendship Hall and sort of talking to people and sort of now listening a little bit more closely, what I discovered was is that those people didn't keep that from me. They didn't know about it either. Mm-hmm. To them, fellowship was what it was all about. They didn't study the big book. They didn't whatever. And then after hearing about the physical, mental, and spiritual problem, Sam then started talking about the physical, mental, and spiritual solution. And again, no wonder why I'm so miserable. I'm going to a lot of meetings. I've been to conferences. I've been to dances. I make a mean cup of coffee. I put away a lot of cups that I didn't drink and a lot of chairs I didn't sit in and a lot of cigarette butts that I didn't smoke. But I'm so lost and I'm so pissed off and I'm so afraid. You see, it's interesting. It's interesting about the mind. You know, the big book talks about something that's really, really important. And that's, we're an extreme example of self-will run riot. The cool thing about our problem, and at first you're not going to see this as something good, but inevitably it is very good, and that is that our problem is so bad that it just drives us nuts. It just grinds on us. It just chews us up and spits us out. And you're either going to kill yourself in all the different ways that you can. You're going to start participating in behavior where we get somebody else to kill us, because that's part of it too. There's such a thing as, suicide by police. There's such a thing as, I stole from a ruthless criminal. We'll get other people to kill us too. You know what I mean? We get involved in stuff that no one should. And in my case, after 3.5 years, I feel incredibly blessed that I was so screwed that God did that and used that to get my attention. And I instantly became desperate, and I instantly saw the depth of my problem. And instantly didn't want to be there anymore. Because for the first time in my life, I saw how bad my problem was. And if you're new, your problem is a whole lot worse than you think it is. Way, way worse than you think it is. I mean, just think about this slogan, okay? Your best thinking got you here, all right? You know what I mean? Like, not your mediocre thinking or your worst thing. My best thinking got me here, like, 4 times, which means my best thinking got me walked right out of here 3 times. You know what I mean? Like, my best thinking got me here multiple times. I can't blame anybody else for that. I always thought that my problems were outside me. I always thought that my problems came at me, but my problems don't come at me. My problems come from me. It's not what you do that's the problem. It's what I tell myself about what you do that's the problem. This is the high wisdom that we need to be hearing about. Most people in the world don't know about that. And they go through their whole entire lives and die completely unawares. But the cool thing is that as alcoholics, otherwise known as an extreme example of self-will run riot, we are so screwed that it's undeniable, because we're just miserable with no spiritual solution. And then Sammy started talking to me about the three-part solution found in the circle and triangle. And again, you know, after he was done, I said to him, you know, why is this news to me? And the circle and triangle, first of all, it's an equilateral triangle within a circle. And the circle represents wholeness. And the triangle, the bottom part says recovery, the left side says unity, the right side says service. The base of the triangle is recovery, which is the 12 steps, the working and the reworking of the 12 steps. The left side of the triangle is unity, which is the fellowship, which is going to meetings and interacting with 12-step people outside of meetings. and what's the governing 12 items there is the traditions, and then service, which is the giving ourselves, expecting nothing in return, governed by the 12 concepts of world service. Now, it's an equilateral triangle, so we have to have all three parts equal in our current program. But the base of the triangle is the program, which is the steps. So that's what everything sits on. As far as I'm concerned, that's sort of where we start. We come to meetings, but we're, the big book and the early literature talk about we're supposed to get into the 12 steps and to experience the 12 steps immediately and quickly. I'm sorry if that's news to some of you. And that was news to me after 3.5 years. Because I had heard, you know, oh, you know, don't get into that. You know, it's, we'll get into that, but not yet, or one step a year, or all the silliness that the human mind can create, which has absolutely nothing to do with reality or the program whatsoever. And that's one of the reasons why next week I'm going to do a workshop that's going to talk about some of that stuff. But whenever I talk about the circle and triangle, the solution part of it, I need to ask myself, where am I currently in the three-part solution? How many meetings have I been going to lately? Where am I in the 12 steps? And in what way am I being of service in AA and outside of AA? I think sometimes here there's too much of an emphasis on being of service in AA. I believe that we need to be of service in our families, to perfect strangers walking down the street, at work, etc., at a gas station, and in AA. So after Sammy had outlined that part of it to me, I was somewhat beat up with the information he had been giving me because it was so important. But once again, I had a blurt, why is this news to me? You know, I'm just going to meetings. I'm not involved in the steps. I'm not involved. I could make coffee, but you better believe you owe me. You know what I mean? And I remember a friend of mine once said that she used to make coffee and she started bringing in banana bread, a homemade banana bread. And one day she changed up the banana bread to have nuts in it, and she was really pissed off because nobody noticed. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you better notice me and you better appreciate me, and now you owe me. You know what I mean? Like, there was no giving myself, expecting nothing in return. I'm just going to meetings. You know what I mean? And little to nothing else. You know, no wonder why I'm so miserable. I'm now getting dosed with how huge my problem is and how little my program is. As a matter of fact, the fellowship is nothing against the fellowship is a cobweb trying to stop a 18-wheeler. You know what I mean? And then that was when I realized the importance of the steps. And that was when I realized the importance of spiritual growth. And that was when I realized that no wonder why I'm so miserable. And Sammy proceeded to tell me that the Area 44 convention was in September, and every year the Berkeley Heights group, which had just started, would do a sort of like a Joe and Charlie weekend in May, just before the summer, and in October, just after the summer. And so there was a workshop that was coming up, coincidentally, and coincidentally Sammy had a flyer for it, so we went, and I started hearing about AA history, and I started hearing about the depth and the importance of the program and the big book and what my problem really was and what my solution needed to be. And I aggressively got into the steps, and every area of my life changed for the better. And that was early 1995, and now it's 2019. And what happened to me then and what's happened to me since reworking the steps occasionally is so incredibly wonderful that I can't stop talking about it. I am annoyingly happy. I'm completely a satisfied customer. For the first time in my life, I was shown, and when put into application, discovered how great the Design for Living, the Big Book 12-Step Program is. It's unbelievable. And I can't stop talking about it. I want to say this, and then I want to do this. I'm going to read this thing, which is really cool. The Big Book is not meant to be understood. It's not meant to be read. It's not meant to be conceptualized or intellectualized in any way. It's not meant to be understood. You literally could read the Big Book from now until the day you die, and 90% of it is going to go right by unnoticed. The Big Book is meant to be experienced, period. And one of the best ways I've ever heard that put about, you know, someone who hasn't done that yet is that the Big Book is not written in English. It's written in sober. And if you're new, you know nothing about sobriety. So you need to find somebody who has had an experience with this book and can translate it in the sober to you. Because, like I said, you could read this book from now until the day you die and you will miss 90% of it. It's really crazy how... it's incredible what is in this book, and you will not see it unless you have sit down with somebody who has had an experience with it and can somehow translate that experience to you. That's why it's ridiculous that they want to translate the Big Book into more common language because they think that'll help people more. It's not going to help people more. It's not meant to be understood. It's not written in English. You can't minimize that. Something was working through Bill that put it on paper in a way that is somewhat miraculous. And what I mean is that he wrote it in a way that's not evangelical, but it definitely lets you know the importance of the spirituality. That is a tightrope that is hard to walk. I would suggest that that's a tightrope that's impossible to walk. Also, what's interesting about the Big Book to me, which proves that it's divinely inspired, is that let's say you have no religious or spiritual background at all or exposure. It meets you where you are and loves you enough to take you past that. Let's say you've had some religious or spiritual exposure. It meets you where you are and loves you enough to take you beyond that. Let's say you have advanced experience with religions and spirituality and stuff like that. It meets you where you are and loves you enough to take you beyond that. A human being cannot speak on all those levels. The Big Book is divinely inspired. It's absolutely amazing. Something was working through Bill to produce what ended up happening in this document. And it's really a miracle. Also, I think I always like saying that I am so grateful to have been born during a period of time where there was something I could do about my alcoholism. Because, you see, prior to 1934, Bill got sober in December 34. Jails, institutions, and death. That's it. On a good day, those were your options. You know what I mean? On a good day, those are your options. Jails, institutions, or death. And yes, jail is an institution, but yeah. And we live at a time where there's something we can do about our alcoholism that works infinitely great. It's a program that's infinitely more wonderful as time passes, if we apply it. Now, I said about the physical, mental, and spiritual solution. I've never known anyone who is currently involved in all three sides of the solution that ever went back out. Okay? But the key word there is currently. You see, the single most important thing about recovery is consistency. Something that an alcoholic is almost impossible to do. We cannot be consistent in anything. You know, when an old timer raises his hand and says, you know, I have 48 years, it does not impress me that he didn't drink for 48 years. What impresses me is this guy stayed in AA for 48 years. That is unbelievable. Consistency is the single most important thing about recovery. It's the single most important thing about spirituality. It's the single most important thing about life, et cetera, et cetera. Because, you see, I might have worked a mean program 10 years ago, but that's not going to be helping me today. I need to be still connected to all that. I still need to be connected with the fellowship and with people in AA. Because we have a built-in forgetter, man. You know what I mean? If we don't keep being reinforced what's important and what's going on here, we just think our way is right out of here. So, but I do know people that, you know, went to a lot of meetings many years ago and then kind of got away from it, that went back out. Or I know people that still go to a meeting every day and kind of never got into the steps, that went back out. I know people that, you know, are heavily involved in the service element and went to many meetings many years ago but kind of stopped and, you know, worked the program but got away from that. It's, for me, it's like a three-legged stool, that a three-legged stool is the most solid structure that there is known to man. But as soon as you start shrinking down or eliminating one of the legs, you're going to be falling over. And that's why it's so important to have a home group, and that's why it's so important to have a network, and that's why it's so important to be accountable to somebody, letting people know what's really going on. Part of our program is we can't have secrets anymore. I'm sorry if that's news to some of you. It talks about in the 10th and 11th step, you know, is there something that we should tell somebody about? Yeah, that's things. Secrets, you know. Because that's our disease, man. Maybe we're not drinking, but, you know, then the secrets and the doing things we know we shouldn't be doing, et cetera, starts to happen. And then we're not telling anybody about it. And then, you know, our disease wants us isolated, and then it can have its way with us. How many funerals have I gone to? It's sad. And it's a program that really works. So where am I currently in the steps, in the working and the reworking of the steps? Where am I currently in how many meetings I'm going to and interacting with others in a genuine way? Where am I currently in regard to being of service? And then I want to close with this. This is something I just discovered recently. And I'm going to paraphrase it sort of. I changed some of the words to sort of AA-ize it. But this is like really heavy, and this is really beautiful. He said, I would define spiritual awakening as being right belief and right thinking taking effect in right action. By right belief, I mean recognizing that A, we human beings understand and control only a tiny fraction of the universe, and B, that there is a presence in the universe, capital P, which is spiritually greater than we are, and which is absolute reality, capital A, capital R. By right feeling, I mean awe and joy in the face of the mystery, capital M, in the universe, and humility in the presence of absolute reality, capital A, capital R. And by right action, I mean trying to bring one's self-centered self into conformity with this spiritual presence, capital P, behind the phenomenon. This real self, capital R, capital S, exists within all of us. AA is not something that you join. It's something that you experience and become. But in the becoming it, you must prove it by your actions. Thanks for letting me share. Yeah.